know that our president or the people we are going to vote for as president aren't crooks.
Do you believe Donald Trump engaged in outright tax fraud?
I think there's incredibly strong evidence of that. I think that it explains thoroughly Donald's reasons for not disclosing. The work that was done by the other three reporters who've been on the show, all about things I've been intimately familiar with, is excellent and accurate work. Donald has a long history of not paying people, of saying things that are not true, not just to the news media, but under oath, of not paying his bills, of stuffing his own pocket while shorting other people. And to Donald, there's nothing wrong with that. You have to understand who Donald is. Donald creates his own reality. Donald is a narcissist, and you and I exist for only one of two purposes, either to adore Donald or to be a foil to build more support from those people who adore Donald.
Well, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us. David K. Johnston, also Russ Buettner and Charles Bagley of The New York Times, and to Steve Riley, speaking to us from USA Today. I'm Amy Goodman. We have three job openings. Check our website. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Next up is the evening news.
Tune in Thursday, June 16th at 10 p.m. for another special live remote broadcast from What the Festival at the Wolf Run Ranch. Once again, we'll be showcasing the musical and visual artists at this year's festival, with interviews, music, and interactions with the producers and the participants, exploring what makes this such a uniquely immersive and entertaining festival. Again, be sure to tune in on Thursday, June 16th at 10 p.m. for our What the Festival broadcast. More information can be found on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Check it out, baby. If the funk gets too hot for your rump, turn the other cheek, bop. Yeah.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the World Beat PDX monthly series featuring Wamba on Tuesday, June 16th at the Analog Cafe in Portland. Wamba plays percussive jazz and funk with a strong World Beat influence and will be playing two sets that evening. Again, that's Wamba on Tuesday, June 16th at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Art of Living, presenting Get Happy Portland, a two-day immersive experience of breathing techniques and meditation by global humanitarian Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. Get Happy Portland takes place July 5th and 6th at the Oregon Convention Center. Tickets and information are available at gethappyportland.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a British member of parliament has been murdered against the backdrop of an intense debate over whether or not the country should leave the European Union.
We will talk with El Farouk Kaki, founder of the Canadian gay Muslim group Salam and one of the world's foremost experts on progressive Islam.
And we'll have a live interview with members of the Portland State University Student Union who held an action at today's school board meeting demanding $15 an hour for school employees.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 16th, 2016. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Natasha. British Parliament Labour Party member Miss Jo Cox was murdered last evening in West Yorkshire. Shortly after the attack, the 52-year-old man was arrested as the main suspect in the shooting and stabbing of Cox. According to the BBC News, bystanders report that the man yelled, "Put Britain first," several times before attacking. Elected just last year, Cox was recently campaigning in support of Britain's continued membership in the European Union. Cox also chaired the parliamentary group Friends of Syria and previously worked as head of policy for Oxfam, an international poverty reduction group. Her husband, Brandon Cox, shared that Ms. Cox would want the world, quote, to unite to fight against the hatred that killed her.
Eric Flores is the second of 27 defendants to plead guilty to conspiracy charges stemming from the 41-day armed occupation of Eastern Oregon's Malheur Wildlife Refuge that was earlier this year. On Thursday, Flores admitted that he traveled to the refuge with weapons and performed guard duty at the compound. In an interview with the FBI, Flores admitted to bringing 7 guns to the refuge and distributing them to the other occupiers. As a part of Flores's plea deal, he agreed to surrender his 7 guns to the federal government. The plea also prevents Flores from owning any weapons or ammunition in the future. His sentencing is set for this December 8th.
5 health centers in Oregon were announced to receive $350,000 in the federal grant money today. The money will be used in these centers to provide oral health care to patients without insurance or money. Lack of oral hygiene may be linked to a variety of other health factors, including cardiovascular disease. The centers receiving the grant include Neighborhood Health Center and the Wallace Medical Concern in the Portland area. Virginia Garcia Memorial Health Center and Cornelius Las Clinica del Valle Family Healthcare Center in Medford and Mosaic Medical in Prineville.
The Presbyterian Church USA will be having its national meeting right here in Portland on June 18th through the 25th at Portland's Convention Center. More than 3,000 commissioners, advisory delegates, and observers from across the country will be spending a week conducting church business and engaging in discussion about current issues and events. The 1.6 million member body is the largest Reformed denomination of the Presbyterian Church in the United States. For more on the issues to be discussed at the Assembly, we go to KBOO's John Shuck.
This is the 222nd General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in the United States and the third in Portland. In 1892, the General Assembly was held downtown at First Presbyterian Church. That was the first General Assembly west of the Mississippi. Again, in 1967, Presbyterians met in Portland during the height of the Civil Rights Movement and rising opposition to the Vietnam War. Two of the most pressing and controversial issues coming before this assembly will be fossil fuel divestment and issues related to Israel's occupation of Palestine. One such proposal before the church is to immediately stop any new direct investment in fossil fuel companies and to make a commitment to divest the church's holdings from fossil fuel companies identified in Dr. Patricia Tull, retired professor of Hebrew Scriptures and author of the book Inhabiting Eden, Christians, the Bible, and the Ecological Crisis, said that it's time for Christians to step up.
There has been in the past and continues to be a strange correspondence between Christians and church traditions that hold a high view of the Bible and at the same time a very careless approach to ecological responsibility.
She said that we need to go through a complete change of what it means to be a human being.
It's a metamorphosis that we're talking about in terms of the way humans live day to day, from top to bottom. That's very, very hard work. And I don't think it can be done just because we're afraid of what will happen to us otherwise. I think it also has to be done because of the love and values that we hold for other people, for people who are perhaps more closer to the ecological edge, more subject to the dangers that we're bringing upon ourselves, and love for our children and grandchildren who are going to live in the world that we are making right now.
Dr. Toll will be moderating the Social Justice Committee at the Assembly, when asked if she specifically supported the fossil fuel divestment proposal.
I do, and not for the same reasons that other divestments perhaps have happened. There seems to me to be a real inconsistency between wanting ecological flourishing and at the same time investing in and profiting from the very market forces that are causing climate change and causing our destruction. And so it's on a just on a rational ground, it doesn't make sense for a body that makes ecological statements like the churches do to also invest in fossil fuel.
In 2014, the Presbyterian Church USA General Assembly met in Detroit. At that meeting, Presbyterians approved by a slim margin to add Caterpillar, Motorola Solutions, and Hewlett-Packard to its Do Not Invest list. According to the Assembly, these companies provide sales and services that make them complicit in Israel's construction of illegal settlements, violation of Palestinian human rights, and other abuses connected with the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Dr. Nahida Gordon, who was born in Jaffa, Palestine, was a young girl during the Nakba, or the catastrophe, in 1948. 750,000 Palestinians were expelled or fled during this war. She still has the keys to her home.
Actually, I have 6 keys from my home, 5 keys from the home, and 1 from my father's business, whose office was in downtown Jaffa. You know, when think about it personally, let's say you decide to go on a vacation. You think you'll be gone for a week. You tidy up your house. You turn off the stove. You turn off the lights. And the last thing you do is you lock the door and put the key in your pocket, and you go on your vacation expecting to come back. Now, many Palestinians really thought, well, we'll leave for safety. In my case, the Israelis were bombing the civilian areas of Jaffa, and the church across the street lost part of its roof from one of those bombings. And my father thought this was too dangerous for us. So he said, well, let's just leave for a few weeks. When things calm down, we can return. Well, they didn't let us return. So many, many people have keys. They even have keys to homes and doors that don't exist anymore. In my case, the front door to our house is still there. I'd rather not that the key works, but that's why the key is a symbol of the right of return. There are many keys with people still. They pass it on from generation to generation. When I pass away, I intend to pass my 6 keys to my children.
Nahida Gordon is the author of the just-released book, Palestine is Our Home, Voices of Loss, Courage, and Steadfastness.
And my book, Palestine is Our Home, is an attempt to show people in the West that the Palestinian culture is alive and vibrant. We are still a community. We are building. We hope for the future. And a lot of us hope for the right of return.
She will be at the General Assembly when it meets at the Oregon Convention Center this week.
There are also a lot of examples of administrative detention of children, Israeli prisons. And on this subject, I'm presenting an overture at the Presbyterian General Assembly for the safety and well-being of children. Torture and mistreatment of Palestinian children in Israeli military jails is well documented by many human rights organizations. And I hope to bring this to the General Assembly and have the church asking Israel to change its ways.
According to Dr. Gordon, Palestinians will be watching the Presbyterians as they consider the Palestinian call regarding the BDS, or Boycott, Divest, Sanctions movement.
They are very much behind this. You may have seen the wall separating Bethlehem from Jerusalem and the other environs. Before the General Assembly in 2014, there was a huge drawing on the wall saying, Presbyterians, please divest. Now, a lot of the Israeli propaganda was saying, well, if you divest or you boycott, you're just hurting Palestinians. Palestinians understand that boycotting and divesting from Israeli companies that profit from the occupation is a good nonviolent means for making change. They've seen this happen historically, particularly in South Africa, and they are hoping that this would be one means for making change in the government of Israel and its actions in the West Bank. So they are very much for it and applaud the Presbyterians for doing this.
Those are the stories of just two of over 3,000 people who will be discussing and debating matters of conscience this week at the 222nd General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA. Visitors are welcome to attend many of the events at the Oregon Convention Center. For KBOO Portland, I'm John Schuck.
Three members of Congress walked out during a moment of silence in the U.S. House of Representatives Monday night, refusing to participate in what they saw as an empty gesture by lawmakers. Today, calls for legislative action on guns grew louder on one side of the aisle, while silence on the issue was ever more deafening on the other. FSRN's Neil Abram has more.
Protest chants and the sounds of traditional brass bands permeated a march by several thousand teachers and their supporters to commemorate the 10th anniversary of a popular uprising that continues to loom in the minds of many who live here. As in 2006, protesting teachers are currently camped out in the state capitol's Central Plaza as part of a labor dispute. Despite the weeks-long action, there are no negotiations with government officials underway. But this year's protests differ from those held a decade ago in that they come in the context of an ongoing struggle over a package of federal labor reforms for education sector workers enacted in 2013. The reforms significantly limit the collective bargaining tools available to teachers' unions while tying job security to regularly administered standardized tests. Teachers in Mexico's poorest states, Chiapas, Oaxaca, and Guerrero, say the reforms unfairly stack the deck against those already working in marginalized communities. They are embroiled in what increasingly appears to be a high-stakes push against efforts to bust the most combative chapters of Mexico's dissident teachers' union, the National Coordinating Committee of Education Workers, known by its Spanish acronym as the CENTE. In Oaxaca, the CENTE is using the anniversary of the 2006 uprising to rally its allies in a broader effort to oppose other reforms enacted by President Enrique Peña Nieto's administration, the most recent of which includes the creation of a so-called special economic zone in the state to entice transnational investment. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca City.
Portland State University students today again marched on the university's Board of Trustees to demand a $15 minimum wage for university employees. Here with Portland State University Students Union is Olivia Pace and a large support group. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
All right. Thanks for coming, Olivia. So first, remind our listeners why Portland State's officials are pushing back against your demands.
Why they're pushing back. So the student union had issued four demands earlier in the year, and those demands were the disarmament of campus security, a living wage of $15 an hour for all student workers, faculty, and staff, the lowering of tuition by way of lowering administrative salaries and breaking with the food service provider Aramark. And specifically for the minimum wage, earlier today after the board meeting, we heard Harry Asube, who's the new communications director, spokesperson for PSU, say that the university will do what is required by law in terms of raising the wage and following Kate Brown's orders with the three-tiered bill that'll be rolled out in the next 6 years, but they have no intention of raising it any faster on their own volition because of the way that it'll affect the PSU budget. And the reason they're looking for that is specifically on the issue of doing this, raising the wage by lowering administrative salaries. They've said that they want to attract the right kind of talent with their administrators and their professors, or specifically administrators. And if we lower the six-figure salaries that the administrators are being paid, then we will not attract talented and qualified administrators.
And what exactly happened today?
Today, we presented each board member with a stack of all the signatures that we've given, that we've collected from students, faculty, and staff and community members. And that is 2,850 signatures that have been collected in the last couple months.
All right. And you mentioned this administrative salary. Could you sketch out where the money is going out of PSU's budget?
Yeah. So in the last few years, our president, Vin Bavel, has created 12 new administrative positions. This is Emma, also with me.
Yeah. Hi. I can speak to some of the statistics. So
basically, and we got a lot of this stuff from information that AAUP, which is the tenure track faculty union, has put together for the last couple salary strikes, and that is that, like, I think the specific figure was between, where did I looked at this, between 2010 and 2013, they created 13 completely new PSU admin positions, all with salaries between $150,000 and $275,000 each.
And the question that needs to be brought up is not only, like, why are they being paid so much and why do we have so many new administrative positions and why do they have these large salaries, but also, like, are they actually serving a purpose on the campus? Like, do we even need these new administrative positions? Because we have, like, a new officer of, like, diversity and inclusion, but you would think that the way to solve, like, issues of diversity and inclusion would be to pay your students living wage so they're not living in conditions of poverty on campus, because if those aren't the issues that are being solved, then what are the issues that these, like, administrators are, like, solving? Like, just they're essentially, like, tokenizing students and using students as a way to boost the reputation of the university, and then telling us that they can't pay us a living wage because these administrators need to be qualified and talented.
So there is an issue of poverty on Portland State's campus, and could you talk about the people who are in this poverty zone because of Portland State's reluctance?
Yeah, so 40% of students on campus, studies have been conducted that said that 40% of PSU students are food insecure, meaning they have a hard time finding a regular supply of food every day. There are 22% of students who have children, so that's 6,000 plus children who are being affected by these conditions of poverty along with their parents who are students at the school. They prioritize being a large, flourishingly profitable university over the quality of life for their students. Like, there's the Blackstone Building, which is a building that has traditionally been for students with children because they have two bedrooms. They have two-bedroom apartments. But they're converting a lot of those into two-bedroom dormitories. So they're basically pushing out students with children because of the way they're converting them. We have a food pantry that is open 2 hours a day. Aramark, who is our food service provider, is supposed to work with the food pantry, but they have done very little. A lot of this is almost coming completely from student dollars, student gas money that's driving the cars, students picking up the food every day. There's long lines outside of the food pantry, but they're only open for a certain amount of time, and they only give non-perishable items. So there's no, like, fruit, vegetables, like,
and
thing.
Also, just in general, like, I looked up these figures a while ago for just, like, national statistics. Multnomah County, 2014, there were basically, I'd say, it says 29,822 enrolled undergrad students whose 12 months income was below the poverty line, and that's plus 11,662 grad students who were living below the poverty line, and that's just one given year. That's just Multnomah County, but, you know, in Multnomah County specifically, you can imagine how many of those students are likely PSU students, given that, like, in terms of going, because this is public institutions specifically.
That's a lot of thousands, so who is supporting your efforts? You aren't just alone on this, right? Who's supporting you in these efforts?
No, so our organization is the Portland State University Student Union, or SUSU. We have support from the Tenured Faculty Union, AAUP, from Jobs and Justice in Portland, from SEIU, 503, from AFSCME, the workers union that many of the Aramark workers belong to. We have very broad community support and support from the ways that we've networked with other activists across the country. So really, it's a matter of the admin and the Board of Trustees getting on board, because we have made a lot of strides in support from faculty and staff at the school. We also have a lot of support from our student government, the new president of the student body at PSU. Layla Forbes, her slate was the only slate that supported Disarm PSU, which is the campaign to disarm campus security. So,
and they supported
a $15 minimum wage.
And this is happening around the country, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
At other campuses?
Yeah, I believe at least recently, I know NYU and Columbia have also, like, in the last couple month or two, have basically said they do their policy of paying a $15 minimum wage to campus workers.
Oh, so it has succeeded at other campuses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
And a lot of universities in California, correct?
Yeah, I know I have data on NYU and Columbia, but I know that there's also been broader, like, legislation in California, so that's likely.
Mm-hmm. And the jobs that you're talking about, what kind of jobs are the that you're including in this package that you're arguing about?
All kinds of jobs, just any like student, faculty, staff, and student workers. I work at a preschool at the PSU campus. I work at Helen Gordon. They pay $9.25 an hour.
Yeah, this includes like administrative assistants, people who have like cleaning jobs, janitorial jobs on campus, food workers in every kind of like aspect of campus, and then a number of like mid or like lower clerical administrative workers. So that's one of the other things about the administration that we think is really problematic is the fact that they're basically subsidizing these huge, huge administrative salaries on the backs of a ton of student and non-student clerical workers who are being paid this low hourly wage at the exact same time.
Yeah, $9.25 an hour, that's about $19,000 a year, right?
Yeah. It's very small.
That's very low. And what kind of plans do you have to do more as things progress?
Well, the academic year is finished up, so it really depends on how the administration and how the Board of Trustees goes forward from here. We have only done the work that we've done because they've been silent and have refused to work with students up until the beginning of this year, and that's when our tactics began to escalate, and we were shutting down convocations and shutting down Board of Trustees meetings because the conditions on campus continue to continue to worsen as the administration stayed silent. So it depends on the choices that they make going forward, and things don't necessarily look good as they're saying that they have no intention of raising the wage, they have no intention of disarming campus security, and they are calling things that student government are putting forward divisive and ill-informed in terms of helping campus climate. So
yeah, I think also then like part of it is just up until this point, it's been kind of maybe a little bit more of an open question whether or not the current system of like administration and governance within PSU and a bunch of other universities is actually something that can result in democratic process and like including and understanding the opinions of students and faculty and staff. And it's been kind of a process where we've been bringing these you know signatures and these petitions and these things for years to this Board of Trustees. And at a certain point, we have to ask ourselves, like, if they're not going to really participate in this process and not make it even a process in the first place, like, what does that say about the system of governance? And like, what can we potentially do about that to make it so it's more democratic?
There you are. And you're on the radio right now. So tell our listeners how they can support your work.
Well, if you're a student at PSU, during the summer, we meet Fridays at 5:30, and during the school year, we meet Monday at 6 p.m. in the basement of the Smith Memorial Student Union. And if you haven't yet, come down and say hi to us and sign our petition for $15 on campus.
Okay, so where was it again?
The basement of the Smith Memorial Student Union.
Smith Memorial, okay.
Fridays at 5:30 for the entire summer is when we meet.
All right. Well, that concludes our interview. Thanks, Olivia, and everybody else for coming in. Let's hear it for your efforts.
Hey!
That was Olivia Pace and friends with the Portland State University Student Union. You can read about their work at www.psusu.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for KBOO News in Depth at 5:45, featuring a discussion of the continuing impact of Measure 11 on Oregon's prison system, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland with Sequoia Wright, featuring stories of activism and organizing in the Black African community in the Portland area. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 72, and low of 50, with a 70% chance of rain in the evening. Today in history, in 1897, a treaty was signed annexing the Republic of Hawaii to the United States. In 1976, a protest by thousands of Black students in Soweto, South Africa, turned into days of rioting when police used violence against demonstrators. The students were protesting the introduction of Afrikaans as the primary language of instruction in schools. Upwards of 700 students were killed in the violence, and June 16th is now commemorated as Youth Day in South Africa. June 16th is also Bloom's Day, a global celebration of the work of Irish writer James Joyce, from whom we get our quote of the day. "History," Stefan said, "is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake."
Toronto attorney El Farouk Kaki is one of the world's foremost experts on progressive Islam. As a refugee from Tanzania, he grew up in Canada and started that country's first gay Muslim group called Salaam. He is also the co-founder of the Human Positive Foundation. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with him this week about breaking down stereotypes and building a unified community.
Because Omar Mateen, the man who carried out the massacre, identified himself as Muslim. And I wonder if you could just talk about that, just the aspect of Islamophobia that's been brought out this week.
Right. So, I mean, I think, first of all, Islamophobia in the United States is also racialized. And so people are racially Muslim on some level. And every time we've seen that there's an act of violence perpetrated by somebody with a Muslim-sounding name or a Muslim background, then it's automatically, it's because he's Muslim. And every Muslim is to blame for it. And so this sort of sense of collective punishment for a collective responsibility then results in this kind of violence and all these microaggressions and not so microaggressions.
So in a certain sense, all Muslims are blamed when a person who is Muslim carries out an attack, whereas in, say, the case of Dylan Roof, who identified himself as a white supremacist, as a Christian, he was not then identified as a Christian. And all Christians, of course, were not blamed for his racially motivated attack.
No, absolutely not. And this is also entrenched in this notion that there is a singular monolithic Islam and that all Muslims are of like mind and like belief. It's a very simplistic analysis of what the world is really like. So it's sort of almost predicated that in the context of being a follower of Islam, you lose all personality and all identity and all intellect, and you're just one collective hive mind. And that, we know, is not true for any group of people, not even white Americans.
And in the media, in the U.S. in particular, there is a lot of criticism about Muslim societies and about Arabic societies as particularly homophobic. Are they more homophobic than the United States or other Western countries? Or is it a different form of homophobia?
I think homophobia manifests in different ways in different places. The United States is alive with homophobia today. We've heard it from presidential candidates down to elected officials. Gay bashings continue to be a reality. And what's ironic is that some of the conservative folks who have always fought against LGBTIQ equality and dignity in the United States and in Canada are the first ones to start using queer bodies and queer experiences and struggles as a weapon in their political agendas. Right? It's kind of gross. But in the event, some of the churches in the United States also fund political activism in Africa in order to enforce or put into place extremely homophobic and violent laws against LGBTIQ people. So because they've lost the legal and social battle in the United States to some degree, they're exporting their hate to other parts of the world. They're still living in the United States and still doing something with their bigotry and with their hate.
You're talking about people like Scott Lively, who went to Uganda to try to promote anti-LGBT legislation there.
Exactly, but he's just the tip of the iceberg. He's the visible part. Millions of dollars go from the United States into those programs, into those strategies in Africa.
I know that many people are afraid this week after what's happened. Have the vigils that you've seen made any of that rapprochement or brought communities together?
Yes, I know individuals from Muslim communities who've gone to the vigils. Some of those images have actually been captured in the media. There's a lot of chatter and conversations in social media. Not all of it is nice, I have to admit, but some of it is really awesome and amazing. So I'm starting to see the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? All sort of coming out as a result of this. But I mean, obviously, this is all reflective of deeper attitudes that have been around for a while. It's not just something that happened as of Sunday. So, and I do caution people that there are political opportunists who will use any tragedy and any group of people to divide and conquer. So we need to be vigilant. And like I said, we have choices. What happens in the future and how it happens depends on the choices that we're going to make in the next little while.
Well, I do want to thank you so much for speaking with us. Again, I've been speaking today with Al-Farouk Kaki. He is a queer activist in Toronto and the co-founder of the Toronto Unity Mosque and is a refugee and immigrant lawyer there in Toronto. Al-Farouk, thank you so much for joining us on KBOO today.
Thank you.
This is Jenka Soderberg for KBOO News.
Today, the U.S. House of Representatives rejected a proposal regarding digital privacy. The proposed amendment would have prevented defense funds from being used to impose mandatory security alterations on providers and users of electronic devices, as well as prevent warrantless electronic surveillance on U.S. citizens. This decision comes in the wake of the Orlando mass shootings. Opponents of the amendment stated obstacles this amendment would create in the investigations of shooter Omar Mateen. The amendment passed twice in 2014 and 2015 before failing in Senate prior to this decision. This reveals a large shift in the House's attitude towards government surveillance since Edward Snowden disclosed the extent of such surveillance in 2013. French demonstrators took to the streets again this week to protest the French Parliament's proposed labor reform bill. The labor protests have affected transportation in France after rail workers, taxi drivers, and Air France pilots protested for better working conditions. The French labor union, known as CGT, said that 1.3 million people protested, but the police estimate it is much lower. The government is trying to roll back the country's labor laws, which offers some of the world's best protections to workers. The reforms make it easier for employers to fire workers, increase hours, reduce pay, and negotiate holidays and special leave, which includes maternity leave. In a report by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, France does very well in a quality of life index, surpassing the United States in work-life balance and safety.
Israeli news site Ynet has today reported that the Israeli government has issued plans to build a concrete wall along the Gaza-Israeli border. Reportedly, this is to halt the use of tunnels out of Gaza. According to Ynet, the wall will be dug to a depth of several dozen meters underground and will also be built above the ground. It'll stretch along 60 miles of the southern border around the Gaza Strip, and it'll cost more than $500 million. The current tunnels, dug by Hamas, the ruling party in Gaza, are used as the only access to the outside world for the people in Gaza, especially after Israel and Egypt have both closed their borders there. The Israeli military has been increasing its use of bulldozers on the Palestinian side of the Gaza border fence, while Egyptian authorities have swamped them with seawater.
In Zimbabwe, police have arrested and dispersed a group of youths staging what was planned to be a 16-day demonstration against the deterioration of the economy, human rights, and President Robert Mugabe's rule. In the past, such demonstrations have been carried out by a now missing journalist and human rights activist, Garakiki Choanza. Reports from Harare.
A coalition of pro-democracy youths set up camp on the 1st of June in a park called Africa Unity Square near Zimbabwe's parliament building to call on President Robert Mugabe to step down. 92-year-old Mugabe has ruled the Southern African country since its independence in 1980. The protesters intended to stay in the park until the 16th, but last Thursday police raided their camp in the middle of the night, arresting 15 people. Officials allege that five co-protesters robbed two women in the park and say the remainder resisted and attempted to obstruct the arrests. Bail for all detainees has been set at $1,000 each, a sum only three have managed to pay. Since the raid, riot police have surrounded the park and have reportedly brutalized the passers-by suspected of ties to the protest. One demonstrator who escaped arrest, Joanna Mamombe, says the government is reacting with fear and panic to legitimate criticism by citizens.
When we were occupying the square, I think the government and the security forces, they just thought that we were playing together in the African square. But to be very frank, it was a protest on its own. So you know in Zimbabwe there is no freedom of expression, there's no freedom to gather. So once they realized that we are gathering there to protest that Mugabe should step down and mobilizing other youth to come and occupy the Africa Unity Square, they to send security agents to disperse us through the riot police by beating comrades who are just passing by the Africa Unity Square and also arresting some of our comrades that are still in remand as we speak.
Among the arrested protesters is Patson Zamara. He is the brother of journalist cum human rights activist Itai Zamara, who was abducted in March 2015 by suspected state security agents for staging solo protests against Robert Mugabe's administration in the same park. Another Occupy Africa Unity Square protester was found dead at a local hotel last weekend after a seven-story fall. The timing and circumstances of the death have fueled widespread speculation that the fall was no accident and the state security forces may be involved. Attorney Obey Shawa is representing the demonstrators and says they are innocent of the charges against them.
The real reason behind their arrest is that they've been occupying Africa Unity Square, which is their right in terms of the Zimbabwean constitution. People have the right to demonstrate and present petitions. Unfortunately, the police knew that they could not charge him for illegally demonstrating or occupying Africa Unity Square because it's not an offense. So they had to come up with these fun charges of robbery and defeating or obstructing the course of justice. We'll be saying this in court and we'll bring to the attention of the court that this is politically motivated.
The activists have been ordered to appear in court later this month. Meanwhile, politicians are starting to gear up for the next presidential elections. Robert Mugabe's wife, Grace, has been touring the country in what many predict could turn into a campaign bid to replace her aging husband. Garika Chaonza, FSRN, Harare.
Yesterday, the deputy commander of the Armed Forces of the United Arab Emirates announced that his country was ending its military operations in Yemen. The UAE is a member of the Saudi-led coalition that intervened in Yemen's internal conflict last year. The intervention was a controversial response to the capture of the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, by Houthi rebels in September of 2014. Houthis are Shia Muslims from the north of Yemen who have received at least political support from Iran, which is the primary Shia power in the region. The Saudis accused Iran of supplying military aid as well and intervened with airstrikes on Sana'a and other Houthi-held areas in March of last year. The UAE's role in the war has been to lend air and ground support, especially in the area around the southern port city of Aden, where the internationally recognized government of Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi relocated after being driven from Sana'a. Around 25,000 Yemeni civilians have been killed since the intervention, most of them in airstrikes on crowded cities like Sana'a, prompting accusations of human rights violations. The UAE denied any argument with its Saudi allies, leading to its withdrawal from the conflict. As of today, it still has troops stationed in Aden.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Abby Solon, Laura Delago, Sam Talner, Davlat Vailadula. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 VH Philoma on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Natasha Delapine.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning, Friday, on KBOO at 7, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn will host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, on Veterans Voice, hosts Marvin and Angie of Northwest Vets for Peace speak with three vets from the group Veterans Challenge Islamophobia, Ramon Mejia, Nate Tarani, and Jake Meyer. At 10, Air Cascadia will not be heard. Instead, we'll have an entire hour of Flashpoints, Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher speaks with Jana Bitten of the Oregon Center for Nursing and the Oregon Action Coalition. Also, Christopher Wallace of the Oregon Student Nurses Association about the